Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am joined today by Mr. Marius Ruart. Marius, how are you doing?
Good afternoon, Nick.
I'm pretty good, pretty good. And I'm also joined today by Mr. John Endres. John, how are you doing?
How's it, everyone? Very well, thank you. A bit chilly, but otherwise, well.
Yes, yes. I'm absolutely loving this weather, but anyway, that's beside the point. So it's been a busy week. The last couple of episodes, we haven't had time to cover everything just because there's been so much going on. We talked about the polling we put out on Wednesday, where we discussed the fact that South African voters are far more sensible than our politicians in many respects. We also talked yesterday about the eventful meeting between Donald Trump and Cyril Ramaphosa. McCorney and I were chatting about all the weird and interesting dynamics about that and what it says about our society and our politics. But something else very important happened this week, and that was the South African budget, budget 3.0, which with all of the fuss around everything else has almost kind of been forgotten, despite the fact that this is the breaking of a deadlock that's been going on for, you know, months and months. So what did this new budget have? To summarize it in sort of simple terms of the type that a moron like me can understand, it seems to be much the same as some of the previous budgets. However, VAT increase has been removed completely, which is a very welcome change, I think, considering the negative consequences that would have had for the lives of South Africans. The debt to GDP ratio is estimated to go up a bit, whereas the finance minister claims, no, this isn't due to any borrowing. It's just due to the fact that our economic growth is not as much as originally forecast. Well, Treasury's been way overestimating our growth rates for a long time now, so that does sound like a bit of a fudge. But anyway, fuel levy, I believe, is going to go up slightly. The inflation-driven increase in income tax is also going to be still in this thing. So basically, they're not adjusting the tax brackets for inflation, which kind of amounts to a stealth increase, although a relatively small one compared to some of the things we were going to be hit with. And, you know, to me, the impression I get is that this budget didn't do the necessary sort of cuts and changes that we actually needed to get our government fiscus in order. There's a lot of promises of R1 trillion for infrastructure, which sounds good. And I think pretty much everyone agrees that the country definitely needs more infrastructure spending. The devil, of course, is in the details. How do you spend that money? You know, if you just give it all to BEE companies and caterers who then don't actually deliver the projects or don't deliver them well, you know, you can spend R2 trillion in infrastructure. It's not going to make a difference. But for me, one of the interesting key points here is that the DA in particular, who supported this budget this time, seems to be preparing for the next budget fight. Because, of course, this dance has to happen again next year, when next year's budget is discussed and voted on in Parliament. And the DA got the concession that there will be a spending review. Now, there's some suggestions in this budget. The projection is that there will have to be some kind of tax increase to raise R20 billion next year, unless the spending review can find that money. Now, I believe that there certainly is enough fat in the government for the spending review to point things out. And I think that's what the spending review is for. It's also another devil is in the details thing. If you have a spending review which is just entirely staffed with sort of cadres, who then produce a report that is either ignored or downplays massive waste, then there's no point in the thing. But if you get a good spending review report, which identifies specific areas of government that can be cut, you set yourself up really well for a big fight, for the next budget fight to say, okay, you're spending all this on, I don't know, you know, handbags for ministers or something. I don't know. You know, you can cut this easily. And why are you cutting teachers and doctors when you are wasting all your money on this? The DA, in their rhetoric on this one, claimed that there are a large number of ghost employees. And they cited PRASA as an example, where I think something like 10% of employees were thought to be ghost employees. That is, people who are on the books and getting a salary, but that money is actually just going to a single person. Anyway, so John, I want to start with you. Firstly, do you agree with my characterization of the budget? And what's your takeaway from all of this? Do you agree that this is not really going to boost our growth rate?
Yes, I do agree with that. And one of the observations we make in our briefings to business clients is that we identified three top constraints on growth. And the first of those constraints is the policy area. So we've got things like employment equity, BEE, National Health Insurance, the new Public Procurement Act that's going to come in at some point, the Bela Bill, all sorts of other laws, a new version of the Mineral Resources Act, I think, being discussed at the moment. All of these things contribute to our low growth rate, and that's one of the constraints on growth. The second family of constraints is law enforcement and rule of law. So the police isn't doing its job. The legal system isn't doing its job. And it means, as a result, that people are not sure about the safety of their assets. And that means that investors are reluctant to invest in South Africa. The third constraint on growth is infrastructure. And that is what you just spoke about, what the president also spoke about in the State of the Nation address in February, where he said that 900 billion rand would be spent over the next 3 years on infrastructure. And the takeaway from this is that when the government speaks about accelerating growth, typically it will say, to achieve higher growth, we need to spend more money. And we're going to spend more money on infrastructure. And the reason they say that is because, firstly, every politician will love the idea of spending more money because it makes them more popular, it makes them more likely to be reelected. And secondly, out of those three areas of concern that restrict our growth, it's the safest one because there will be no opposition. Nobody's going to be against the railways being fixed. Nobody's going to be against the roads being fixed, the ports being fixed, the electricity working, the water working, and so on. So it's popular. It's an easy choice to make. But the thing is, even if those infrastructure investments do work properly, and there's a question mark over that, as you also point out, then as long as those other two areas don't get addressed, which is rule of law and the policy environment, then our growth rate is not going to lift very much. So we might get, you know, from 0.6%, I think we had last year, we might double our growth rate. So we'll get to 1.2%. But that's still not enough to make a substantial dent in our unemployment numbers, to get incomes up, or for that matter, to save the public finances. So what our finance minister, what Mr. Godongwana needs, is a much higher growth rate that accelerates revenue for the state and enables us to reduce the deficit and reduce the debt, reduce our debt service costs. And that'll put him in a much better position, as well as the government, without even talking about the rest of us, you know, taxpayers and ordinary people who live in South Africa and are looking for opportunity to improve our lives. So yes, I think we're not looking really at higher growth rates in South Africa. And I think this budget is not going to deliver them. It's not really the finance minister's job to deliver growth. That's a sort of a whole of cabinet and government job. But that's what's needed if we want to get into a better position as a country. And that is going to solve Mr. Gerungwana's headaches as well. Nick?
Before I move to Maurice, John, what do you make of the spending review?
Yeah, so I think that's one. There's a political angle to it, of course, which is that in this big VAT battle, it's actually the DA that walked away with quite a considerable victory, because not only did they get the VAT increases to be cancelled, but they also got the spending review that they'd been asking for. And they also got this vetting of ghost employees that they'd been asking for. And I think, you know, for the DA, that's a pretty good win. That's probably as much as they could have hoped for, given the constellation of power, the balance of power in the cabinet. And it does set them up for next year, I think. You know, if the spending review says, here's 10% that we can get our spending down as a state, well, here's budget time. Let's see it translated into action. And also, just to mention, one of our big campaigns is the campaign to cut BEE premiums. So Gabriel Krause's research indicates that there's probably around 150 billion rand or so that could conservatively be saved out of state spending if public procurement was just put onto a value for money basis. So currently the law is set up in a way that caters for overspending by design. The state is entitled to spend more than it needs if it is in pursuit or in aid of transformation, but it is still overspending. The Treasury currently does not know the amount of overspending, even though it has an obligation to establish that amount. So one of our campaigns also at the IRR, and especially being pushed by Gabriel, is to get Treasury to do the numbers and say, are we overspending by 2% or 10% or 40%? Let's at least know how much the overspending is so that we can see what the cost of transformation in public procurement is. And we might say at 2%, it's actually pretty low. But then why do we need such complex laws in public procurement, all the preferencing point systems, et cetera, for a 2% benefit that hardly seems worth it? Or vice versa, it might turn out to be a very large number. We might be overspending by 50%. And then we would say, well, that's not a very good idea either, because we are empowering tenderpreneurs, a small number of black-owned businesses is getting the benefit, good for them. But the rest of society is receiving fewer services of worse quality. When roads are being built to villages, when water systems are being upgraded, there's less work being done as a result of intended overspending than could be done. And the people suffering the consequences of that are ordinary people, both black and white. So that's not a good system. So yeah, public spending is a huge area of improvement for South Africa potentially. And it's good that the spotlight has been cast on this as a result of the VAT battle.
So it seems to me that despite all of the fiscal pressures, our political system has, in a sort of a way, kind of almost managed to kick the can down the road again, on making some of these hard choices, which is quite masterful. You've got to hand it to our politicians for their inability to make real changes. But that being, as I said, I do think that next budget battle may even be more dramatic. Either it will be far more specific and vicious, or it will actually maybe bring some change. We'll have to see.
But will it be as public as the question? So are they going to
That
hide
is an
behind
interesting
closed doors and
question.
figure out what they want to do
Well,
jointly?
I think the political strategy behind the spending review is in part actually to make it, you need that stuff in public because you want to say you are choosing to either raise taxes or cut spending on services in order to fund this stupid thing or pay for these workers who don't exist. And that's a very powerful tool because you can kind of stand on that as a soapbox. Obviously, that requires also some political skill to be able to use. So we'll have to see how the DA and other parties run with that and what the spending review finds. Maurice, let's go to you on the politics of all of this. I thought the GNU was going to be a little bit more dead than it is. I thought it was only going to exist continuing in name. After the second budget fight, the ANC was very upset by the whole thing. But everyone seems to have kind of shut up a bit. I know in Parliament the ANC has been quite aggressive towards the DA, but in the public media space, it does seem like tensions have calmed down a bit, and that there's sort of a, I don't know what to call it, but a ceasefire maybe, in tearing apart the GNU. It seems at the moment that like a very dysfunctional couple, they just can't quite quit each other. What's your take on this?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, as the saying goes, politics makes for strange bedfellows, but sometimes those bedfellows have to stick together. But I was at Tony Leon's book launch last night, and he made an interesting point. He said the DA actually hasn't managed to do too much in cabinet. They've been hamstrung a bit. There have been a couple of things they managed to do. Leon Schwabe at Home Affairs, Dean McPherson, sorry, at infrastructure and public works have managed to do some stuff. But he said the DA's real strength in the GNU is still in Parliament because the ANC couldn't just pass this budget as they've been used to doing for the past 30 years. The DA said, look, we're not going to support the budget. Sorry for you guys. You guys got to make some concessions for change. And they don't have to do that in cabinet because obviously cabinet posts are at the complete prerogative of the president, and the DA got far fewer cabinet posts than they're entitled to you know, if we were looking at proper proportional representation of cabinet posts. But that's not the case in Parliament. The DA's got 21 or 22% of the seats in Parliament, whatever it is. And the ANC, does it, they need them unless they want to go to MK and the EFF. And as I think on the current leadership of the ANC, they're very loath to do that. Things might obviously change if Paul Mashatile becomes the president of the ANC. So overall, I did think this does show South African politics. I think this is working. The GNU is working to a degree how it should. It does seem to be a bit of a kicking the can down the road. But I think if the DA wasn't here, we'd probably had a much worse budget. We'd have got 17% VAT probably. There wouldn't have been commitment to spending reviews and so on. And yeah, I mean, it's also, I think the DA's strategy in the GNU has got to be, can't be a blitzkrieg. It's got to be a war of attrition or trench warfare. It's not something, they can't come in and just change things. It's got to be very slow, meticulous and, taking an inch by inch. They're not going to come in and, there's not going to be a race to Paris and they're going to take Paris within 2 days of landing in Normandy. You know, it's going to be very slow, attritional warfare. And I think that is what's happening. And as I say, I mean, it's obviously not a great budget, but I think it's much better than it could have been.
Yes. If we are grading on the curve of many previous budgets, it's definitely better than some of those, but still, yeah, not great. Just staying on this, Maurice, I wonder whether the sort of show of support for Ramaphosa by Steenhuisen at the White House was useful for the dynamics of the GNU. So there's been some criticism of Steenhuisen saying that he didn't, attack Ramaphosa on the international stage and bring up the fact that he was being really weaselly about expropriation without compensation, about race laws, about all these sort of things. But I wonder whether there might be some benefit to the DA now that, the ANC has, for a moment at least, perhaps seen that actually there's some sort of value in keeping a coalition with these guys, which is that it gives them a credibility on the international stage that they are perhaps sorely lacking, which might change the dynamics. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that. And as you say, Steenhuisen has been criticized quite a lot, but I think he acquitted himself very well in the White House, and I think what he said was
spot on. Just on that point, I think getting a word in edgeways in that environment was kind of difficult. I don't know if you saw Ramaphosa during the meeting keep trying to say something and Trump just ignored him.
Exactly. But also I think, farm murders are obviously a problem in South Africa, but logically it just doesn't make sense that there's a white genocide going on in South Africa and the South African delegation was basically half white. Just logically, that doesn't compute. That doesn't mean to ignore the terrible farm murders and say that's not saying there's not a problem with farm murders and so on. But just logically, I mean, a Nazi delegation wouldn't have gone to Washington with half the people made up of Jews, or a Hutu delegation from Rwanda wouldn't have gone to London with half the people made up of Tutsis. It just simply doesn't make sense. And I think, as you said, it does give South Africa I think it does look a bit better on the international stage when you do have this, quite multiracial team and so on. And but it's the first time really in many years that the ANC hasn't paid lip service to non-racialism. It's actually had to be, okay, well, we actually have to show that we are a multiracial organization and so on. So I think, and I think it has strengthened the GNU. I think, imagine that the DA never joined the GNU and EFF was in in the GNU instead. You know, imagine Julius Malema as the deputy president or minister of agriculture and he's sitting in the White House now. I mean, there's part of me that actually wishes that would have happened because that, I think that would have made fantastic television. It would be better than having Zelensky there. Imagine Trump having got Malema and trying that video. But yeah, overall, I think it was pretty, I think this probably has strengthened the GNU, at least for now. And I think it's probably in the long term, it's strengthened as well.
Yeah, for me, the funniest moment of the entire meeting was the moment at which Ramaphosa sort of goes, "And I have a minister of agriculture. He's right over there. Look, he's white." Which is not exactly something someone says when they're full of confidence about their non-racial position. I don't know.
But it's also it's the GNU version of "But I've got black friends," "But I've got a white guy."
No, it was very funny. John, what's your take on all of this?
Yeah, I thought it was not useful to tokenize John Steenhuisen by referring to his race. But I do think that Steenhuisen's intervention was a good one in the sense that he drove a binary between what he called the rabble, which was, Julius Malema, the EFF, Jacob Zuma, MK, and the good guys in the setup is the ANC and the DA together defending against the rabble, so to speak. So it probably makes it a bit harder inside the ANC to sell a coalition with the EFF or MK, which is good in a way. But on the other hand, it also creates the sort of, in terms of messaging, what does it say to the Americans? So the Americans now, what they're hearing is there's some very crazy people who are close to power in South Africa, and there's sort of a thin line preventing them from getting their hold on their hands on power. Does that inspire confidence? Are the Americans now going to say, well, in that case, let's invest. That's going to be, let's make sure we keep those people out. I don't know.
Well, probably not, but I think some of that may be by design, which is that Steenhuisen is basically trying to say, us in the DA are vital to keeping the country, away from your enemies, which is, I think strategically quite clever now, because if Ramaphosa wants to break up the GNU and get into bed with the EFF and MK, that exchange makes his life even more difficult than it would otherwise be. Let's go on to our next story. And this one is about Starlink. So for a while now, the communications minister, Solly Malatsi, who is from the DA, has been working away in the background with a little bit of public attention, but not that much, looking potentially to change the regulations about ownership. In this case, the idea has been that you can change the regulations on. So currently, it requires that if you want to set up, for example, an internet thing in South Africa, in this case, Starlink, Elon Musk's internet company, or any foreign company that wants to provide communication services here, you have to have a local partner who is sort of 30% owned by, I believe the phrase is historically disadvantaged individuals in the legislation. So basically, an entity that's 30% black-owned. And the idea about how to sort of change this to make it easier for foreign investors to get into the country is that rather than require having a strict ownership requirement, you'll say, okay, well, we'll still have the sort of BEE points, but now you'll be able to contribute to them with other things, investing in local suppliers, enterprises, skills development, job creation, infrastructure support, research and innovation, digital inclusion initiatives. So presumably that would mean things like, giving Starlink to rural schools or providing training seminars or, building a well or a road or something for a rural community. Who knows? There are many things that companies could do. And the headlines today on a lot of sort of internet-focused sites say, I think this one is from mybroadband.com or .co.za, says Starlink breakthrough in South Africa. And what is, yeah, look, I don't speak very good legalese, but it's interesting to me how it's the sort of description. So what's happened is Solly Malatsi has put out in the Government Gazette these sort of proposals to change the regulations in the kind of direction I've been describing. But the language is so sort of downplaying it and kind of soft-soaping it. It's sort of like, even if companies are not rolling out large-scale infrastructure, they will be required to make commitments that are substantive and clearly aligned with South Africa's socioeconomic development goals. ICASA's regulations may continue to require 30% equity ownership by historically disadvantaged individuals, but may also permit commitments in the ICT sector code as valid conditions for applicants for individual licenses. So, a sort of strike at the heart of the employment equity and BEE agenda. This is not quite. This is much more downplaying it all. But John, we were discussing this beforehand. Let me, for a moment, play sort of devil's advocate. Tactically, maybe this is part of the strategy, is that you're not, in order to get this regulatory change passed, you're not going to take on the whole of BEE. You're sort of just going to create like a little slip through where you can hopefully increase investment without the ANC just immediately blocking it in some way. I don't know. What's your take on this, John?
Yeah, it sort of feels very distasteful to me and not really useful. So firstly, I would agree with you from reading the reporting on the supposed breakthrough. It's hard to figure out what's going on. There's lots of talk of alignment between the Electronic Communications Act and the communication sector codes and the Department of Digital Communications and BE and transformation and this and that and the other. But how those things are meant to now all be aligned is unclear to me. It seems that maybe there's this loophole that says that as an investor, you have to dedicate 30, that's a lot, to some sort of alternative to BE. So instead of giving a share in your company or selling it to an empowered, politically connected person of the right skin color, you will be permitted to be forced to pay the same amount of money to other purposes, like, I don't know, education, infrastructure, who knows, something like that. So it just seems very unclear to me. And it may be that there's some obfuscation going on purposefully, you know, that the minister, who is from what used to be an opposition party, is moving extremely cautiously, not to upset the ANC. But I wonder if this is enough of a significant move to attract any investment. Or is an investor going to look at this and say, look, you know, you're still taxing me 30% before I even put a single cent in your country? This is not attractive to me. You know, it's nice that you've removed the race-based element of it. Have you really? I can't quite figure it out. It still talks a lot about transformation, which is code speak for demographic representativity. So there's still a racial element, there seems to be. Anyway, I find it unconvincing and not really a significant step in the proper direction. A significant step in the proper direction would be we welcome investment and we're not going to put demands that make it difficult for them to bring their money and invest in our country. That's what I would say. Nick?
Maurice, your takeaway?
Yeah, I think we need to see what the actual regulations end up in, but this could be the thin end of the wedge. You know, I think there is, I mean, ANC politicians, if you do some research, even more than 10 years ago, people, you know, people like Gwede Matashe and Thavin Gordhan were saying, we can't carry on like this. We can't pay 50 Rand for a bottle of water to, you know, build a middle class. There's actually been an acknowledgement, an implicit one, I think, with a lot of people in the ANC that BE simply not working. But it's such a strong tool of patronage. It's very hard for them to give it up. But also just, you know, talking about transformation and so on. Nobody knows what transformation means. Does it mean just pure representativity? Maybe it does. But I think a very good example here is the Springboks, actually. You see a lot of people talking about, you know, this is such a strong team and it's so transformed. And look, it's more diverse than teams from 10 years ago, whatever. But the team's still, you know, 50 or 60% white. But nobody cares because they're winning World Cups. And Rassi is quite a vancular guy, and he's, you know, he seems to have, like, you know, kind of the people's touch or whatever. You know, he's like quite an approachable guy and so on. I think even if we had a guy like Hanukkah Meyer getting these kinds of results with the same team, you actually wouldn't say that the team's transformed. But because the team's transformed now because it's winning and so on. And I think you'd maybe see something actually in South Africa. I mean, this is maybe me talking complete rubbish, but apart from ideologues within the ANC, South Africa would be seen as being transformed if we were a winning country, if we were growing at 5 or 6% a year, and we were seeing people in jobs, and we were seeing, you know, proper houses being built all over the place, and, you know, roads and hospitals and all that kind of stuff. We'd be a transformed country if we were a winning country, which this, you know, which I think is a, you know, maybe I'm taking these sports metaphors a bit far, but yeah, but I think that is part of it, because nobody can explain what does transformation mean. There's no definition of it. We always get told it's an imperative in the Constitution, which I'm not sure it is actually. But yeah, it's nothing there. It's transformation is justified racism, bees, legalized looting. Dirk could see us in the comments. Probably right.
So our colleague Michael Morris has actually, I think, made a strong point in this, which is that, you know, when you hear a word like transformation, the implication is that society is sort of transformed. And what do we mean by that? Well, if you're not a crazy person, you would say that means that we don't have most South Africans living in poverty, misery, and despair, like many do today, probably most. And he's kind of made a case almost for sort of taking the word away from the race ideologues, who, as John, you know, points out, is almost always use it in the sense to mean strict demographic representativity and social engineering, to mean what is it, you know, what does it actually take to transform the society into one that was a sort of a racial caste system, you know, enforced by apartheid, to one that is a genuine, thriving, succeeding, poverty-free, democratic, liberal society. And, you know, getting rid of BEE then in that case would further transformation, because it would take us closer to a society where most people don't have to worry about having food the next day. I mean, obviously, it's only one piece of that very large puzzle. But final thoughts, John?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, it's something we complain about internally. It was the hijacking of the word liberal by American progressives, which we're quite upset by, because we think liberal is a great term. It's got, you know, liber in it, which means free, and it's all about freedom, individual freedom. But transformation is similar in the sense that this would be a nice term for us to hijack and say that the kind of transformation we want is transformation from poverty to wealth, from unemployment to jobs, from low living standards to high living standards, you know, from a losing nation to a winning nation. That's the kind of transformation you want. But many of the so-called transformation policies lead us in the opposite direction. They're sort of taking us away from that kind of good transformation towards being successful and making us as a nation less successful. And that is, I think, a semantic change that we should actually be pushing for to get the right kind of transformation in South Africa.
I've always said South Africa needs radical economic transformation, but just not the kind envisioned by Ace Magashule and Tony Ngeni. You know, it's the kind of radical economic transformation you've seen in places like India, for example, or Eastern Europe since the end of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, no, exactly. Okay, let us go on to our next story. This is one that's sort of framed in an interesting way in the reporting. I think this is from Business Live. The headline is, "The case of the minister and the HIV activists, are we entering denialism 2.0? So this article begins by saying, two decades after South Africa's denialism battle, HIV scientists and government are once again at odds, with scientists accusing the health minister of denying the impact of US funding cuts and the minister blaming activists in the media for exaggerating the crisis. Well, it then has this great description here talking about the state of South Africa's HIV/AIDS program. The article says, in the leafy office park not far from Charlotte Maxweke Hospital, Academic Hospital, you'll find these collection of vehicles just past the security boom. Dozens of vehicles, leftovers from what were once busy, purposeful operations, sitting under the high felt sun. The engines are dead and the tires are flat. Until recently, these brightly painted trucks and trailers emblazoned with PEPFAR and USAID logos were on the move, part of a push to take HIV services to groups of people that government clinics often didn't reach. But this was, of course, before the cut to our HIV/AIDS program that was ordered by Donald Trump. So there have been a lot of activists who are very upset about this. They say that government is not properly replacing these programs, that even though government says that only 17% of our spending was from the Americans on HIV/AIDS, that in reality, the program had a lot more infrastructure that was being run by the Americans than that 17% would have you believe. Aaron Motsoaledi, the health minister, who on this podcast we are not a big fan of, said that the media and activists were trying to make the country look bad. They were spreading disinformation and they were making an Afroforum style scene to spread disinformation. Well, I guess the sort of takeaway from this one is that, let me read the comments from the minister exactly. He said, I want to state it clearly that propagating wrong information about the start of the HIV/AIDS campaign in South Africa in the manner that it's being done is no different from the approach adopted by Afroforum and its ilk, which led Trump to trash the whole country. I'm saying so because we have already been phoned by a few funders who have spoken to us who are asking why they should put their money in the programs that are said to be collapsing. Is their money going to collapse together with the program? What's the lady insisted that, you know, the government was putting in measures to help those who had lost healthcare through the funding program. What was interesting in this, there were some other sort of kind of social observations in this article about how a lot of, for example, prostitutes would, or sex workers, as they are described in the piece, were afraid of going to government hospitals. They preferred to go to the US funded clinics because often apparently nurses will tell them that they don't deserve to be helped, and refuse to give them medication or just kind of make their lives difficult. And apparently the NGOs didn't do the same thing. And there's a bunch of people now, a significant number of people now, who are unfortunately falling off of their treatment, which is pretty bad. There are some estimates from various HIV/AIDS activists that the number of new infections in the country may double, and that number, and the number of AIDS-related deaths may go up by around 38%. So we don't know if that will come to pass, but that's quite chilling statistics. So there's a lot of angles to this story, but Marius, one of them, I guess, is that the health minister just seems so defensive and so aggressive when there's any kind of criticism. We've seen this also on NHI, is that every time someone criticizes NHI, he's like, ah, you're just rich, racist scum who are trying to keep healthcare from the poor. What's your take on this?
Yeah, I think it just shows he's obviously a very thin-skinned person who can't take criticism, because now he's, you know, if it's not doctors' associations or organizations like ours going at him for NHI, it's, you know, these AIDS activists. And they'd probably be on the other side of the ideological spectrum from us, but we're all obviously, you know, a bunch of morons who are just trying to attack Motsoaledi. But I mean, this is something where the government, we've been too reliant on external funding for this kind of thing. And it's vitally important that these kinds of things get funded. You know, there's a lot of things that we should be paying for, but this is, I think, one of the most important things in the country. And I'm just looking at South Africa's life expectancy now. It's at 66 now. In 2019, it was 66, went down a bit because of COVID. In the early 2000s, it was down to 54. And that doesn't mean, obviously, everybody lived to 54 in South Africa. It's obviously an average, but it's because of how many people were dying in their 20s and 30s and 40s from AIDS. And we're going to start seeing this again, and it has all kinds of other knock-on effects. You know, people get taken out of the workforce, and it's, resources that have to be spent on ill people and so on. And AIDS, basically, if you get proper medicine, AIDS is basically a lifestyle disease. It's actually easier to manage than diabetes, for example. But you need to be able to fund this kind of thing. And the US government has no obligation to do this. I mean, I think it's probably a mistake that they have stopped funding this, but they can do whatever they want with their money. And this is where South Africa really needs to step up. And this is one of the things where we really have to find money for. And we need to, I don't know, rent out the union buildings or something, because the people are going to die now because of this. And we can't blame Washington for it. This is because of mistakes Pretoria has made.
Yeah, I'm sort of struck reading through this that it really does seem that South Africa had no sort of plan to one day replace PEPFAR with our own infrastructure. I mean, what, were we just going to continue, expect the Americans are going to pay into our healthcare system forever? I think PEPFAR is a great program, and I think it's sad that it's been cut, but, you know, like, surely there should have been some contingency for, okay, but, you know, we can't rely on a foreign country to fund our healthcare. John, I believe the phrase you used in the pre-show discussion was something along the lines of, and apologize for swearing, but something like, we've got to sort our own shit out. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so it's something harsh to say, because, you know, we are talking about people's lives, so it is grave. It is a grave matter. So it should not be a laughing matter. But at the same time, I do think, so I agree with Marius, and I agree with the viewers who put in the comments that, you know, this is not somebody else's job to fix our health. This is something we as South Africans should take charge of. And I would also add, as another wrinkle to the argument, you'll see in that story which you shared, that it says people appreciated that they were able to get free healthcare, from wherever. Why do we have so many poor people in South Africa who are dependent on free services? Why are there not more people who've got higher incomes who are middle class or wealthy who would be able to pay for this themselves if, for example, funding from the United States dried up as it has done now? And the reason why we've got so many poor people is because we've got anti-growth policies and our economy hasn't grown for 15 years. So people don't have the resources to look after themselves. And again, this is a failing of the sense of taking responsibility for your own life, for the state of your own economy, if you're the government, and for taking responsibility and making sure that you get things right in your own backyard. That is something we need to start doing. And maybe in a sense, if there's anything good coming out of the cancellation of the USAID funding, it is that it forces us to confront the need to take responsibility for our own affairs. And hopefully that is one of the lessons that as a government, we draw from this, and that we get the economy growing so that people can also take care of their own needs instead of being dependent on the government or on foreign governments. Nick.
No, exactly right. And that's, once again, I guess what we would mean by a transformed society. A transformed society would be where the majority of citizens would be able to, you know, sort themselves out if they contracted HIV. If you're a middle-class South African with proper, you know, health insurance, you're going to be able to just go to your doctor who will prescribe you medication that you will then have paid for by your medical aid. The fact that so many people have to go to doctors, to clinics where they're mistreated or where the services aren't available or other things is an indictment in and of itself. And there will never be enough money to look after everyone to the standard that I think people should be treated, because we're too poor a society. We need to make ourselves a wealthier society. All right. What else to talk about today? I think let's call it there. There was some comments by the CEO of, maybe John, I can just get your thoughts on this one very briefly. The CEO of the investment firm 91 saying that South Africa is on the brink of an economic emergency due to runaway unemployment crisis. My sort of takeaway from when I saw that was, you know, we have 40% unemployment. The crisis is here. We're not on the brink of anything. We've been in a crisis for at least 10 years now. I don't know, John, if you have anything to add to that.
Yeah, so I'd agree with that. It is a crisis. It's a very long-standing one, a slow-moving one. But it's also worth pointing out that just because things are bad doesn't mean they can't get worse. So, you know, if we get sanctioned, if the Trump administration says American banks are not allowed to buy South African bonds anymore, or insists that American banks have to sell the existing bonds they've got of South Africa, or, you know, any number of economically damaging measures could lead to a very rapid devaluation of our currency, to a rapid increase in our cost of living through imported inflation, to even higher rises in unemployment, to divestment out of South Africa. All of these things are real risks, as well as driven through local politics. So, you know, if we get somebody in charge of the Reserve Bank or the Treasury who is not as responsible as the current incumbents are and is sort of much more willing to print money in order to, you know, achieve whatever social goals, or drop the interest rate to zero for social goals, or increase spending, state spending, double state spending, why not? all of this can lead to a blowout in the economy. So currently we're in a pretty delicate position. It is precarious, but it's risky, you know. So it's just one more reason for us to get our act together, take responsibility for our state of affairs as a country, and reduce our vulnerability. We are very vulnerable to all sorts of risks at the moment. Nick.
Completely agree. All right, let's call it to a close there. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening today. We hope you found the show interesting. We will, of course, be back on Monday. I hope you all have a wonderful weekend, and we will see you all next week on The Daily Fringe Show. Cheers, everyone.